Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. This is Erin Rhoda, Deputy Editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to informing Mainers through investigative and explanatory journalism and empowering them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, the Monitor's reporters and editors talk about the stories we are working on, many of which you have likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. Today, I'm joined by Rose Lundy, who covers public health and is here to talk about her reporting on opioid addiction. The opioid epidemic is still primarily a problem among younger people, but as it has worn on, Rose has found a change has been happening that's largely gone unnoticed. More older adults are seeking treatment for their addiction to opioids. Thank you for joining us to hear more about this important issue. Rose, tell us why you decided to look into opioid use among older Mainers.
So I saw some data about how older Americans are starting to be more impacted and are a growing group of people who are struggling with opioid use. I think it's important, like you mentioned, that this is still primarily a disorder that impacts younger people, but we are seeing nationally that Americans who are 65 and older are starting to struggle with opioid use disorder. There's been a threefold increase among Americans in that population between 2013 and 2018. So I thought that was a pretty striking national statistic. And since Maine has the oldest population, I started to wonder, well, what are we seeing here? You know, presumably if there's something that's starting to impact older adults as the oldest state in the country, we would maybe start seeing that here before other places. And so I reached out to a lot of people across the healthcare spectrum and across the state, talked to people in primary care and in the treatment community and in the recovery community, and I even went out with a street medicine team who work with the unhoused population just to see what people are saying and seeing in their practice. And it was pretty interesting with the responses that I got. Some people have seen no change, no increase, notably Maine Health Behavioral Health, which is the largest, part of the largest health system in Maine, said that they haven't really seen a change. But then there were some people that are starting to really see anecdotal increases in the older patients that they serve. Members of this street medicine team that I went out with, they are seeing on the ground an increase in older adults. I spoke to somebody with Northern Light Acadia Hospital who said that her patients who are 65 and older doubled in 10 years. It was as a small number of patients, but a doubling is pretty notable. And then some of the primary care doctors that I spoke to saw anecdotal increases and said that they've started to see an uptick in the older adults they serve. So that was all really interesting, but it was all anecdotal, data. And so we also started to think about, well, how can we kind of look at the data more in depth and try to see if there's really some numbers that could speak to these anecdotal experiences. And so we looked at Medicare claims data. So, we looked at just the Medicare recipients in Maine who are 65 and older, because there are some people with disabilities who are younger who receive Medicare. And we looked at those who have been given treatment for opioid use disorder. And so we learned that between 2019 and 2023, there was a 70% increase in Medicare recipients in Maine who were receiving buprenorphine to treat their opioid use disorder. So that was an increase from 638 to 1,087 people receiving that medication. And It's important. So that's a 70% increase, whereas the population of older Mainers increased about 12% during that time. So as you know, we are an older state and we're getting older, but the percentage of people receiving buprenorphine is outpacing the population change. And so it's also important to note that that's probably an undercount because we only looked at buprenorphine. So we didn't look at naltrexone and methadone, which are also used to treat opioid use disorder. And we also didn't include some categories of buprenorphine that had been suppressed for having too small of numbers to be published. And so it could be possible, but that those numbers are even bigger. But what that tells us is that there are more older adults seeking treatment for opioid use disorder, and just in the recent years. And so that could start to grow. It's also important to note that those it's a relatively small number, so it's 450 people, an increase of 450, which may be spread across the state, is not as dramatic in individual practitioners' offices, but some of those practitioners that we've talked to are starting to see that increase, and they're starting to notice it in their daily life and think that it could be a trend that could continue.
Yeah, wow. You've done so much work on this. Talked to so many people across the state, and in addition to that data analysis, which was, as I understand it, the first time that someone had published a look at buprenorphine prescriptions among people who are 65 and older on Medicare. Is that correct?
I hadn't seen it elsewhere. I mean,
And is this a trend that we are seeing everywhere in Maine?
no, so that's where it gets interesting because, like I said, there are some people who have definitely seen an increase, but then there were quite a few people that I reached out to who said that they had not seen an increase. And so, in particular, it's important to remember that this is a smaller portion of the population that's struggling with opioid use. In the state, total overdoses continue to plummet, and for all age groups, and older adults make up a relatively small portion of those overdoses. So Mainers who are 65 and older made up 12% of non-fatal overdoses last year and 13% this year, whereas they make up 23% of the population. For comparison, there are other groups that make up a larger portion of the overdoses. So Mainers who are 35, between 35 and 44 made up 26% of non-fatal overdoses, and they made up 12% of the population. So, it's understandable that some of the experts that I spoke to said, it's important to look at all age groups and to try to help everybody who is struggling with opioid use disorder. But there are some age groups that are more impacted and are a bigger portion of the population. And so, I talked to the state and they said that opioid use disorder is an adolescent onset disease. And so the vast majority of people who struggle with substance use disorder started before they were 18. And so when you talk about prevention and trying to save more life, you try to really focus on younger people. And so that's certainly an important element of this conversation. But there were a number of other people in the healthcare field who said that, this is a growing problem. We're seeing the increase of older adults struggling with opioid use, and we're starting to see it on the ground and in daily practice. And so we're the oldest state, we're just going to get older. And so the state needs to start thinking about how we will plan for helping address the need going forward.
Yeah. Let's dig into a little bit what some of those individual people said who you interviewed. You talked to people who described the type of patient maybe that they're seeing present to them. What did they tell you?
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, first and foremost, they said that, older adults might not fit the stereotypical idea of someone who's impacted by opioid use, but we're starting to see it more and more. So one person I spoke to who works directly with people struggling with substance use, she talked about how she sees primarily older women, very frail women, and the patients she works with primarily inject rather than smoke their substances, and she's seeing primarily fentanyl. And a lot of the people I talk to who are seeing increases in older adults with who they work with said fentanyl is a big part of it. And so, a lot of them. A lot of their patients started with prescription opioids. And then, one person said that as there was a regulatory crackdown on overprescribing, which people say was important to do. But as that happened, some people turned toward illicit drugs. And so now they're seeing more older adults struggling with illicit drug use. Which is not something that some of these medical practitioners had seen before. One primary care doctor said that you never used to see an older adult in treatment centers who are struggling with illicit drug use, and now you are seeing it. And so that does need to be on people's radar when trying to identify if an older adult has an opioid use disorder. That they might be struggling with illicit opioids.
Yeah. You also went out with a street medicine team in Bangor and spoke with people and learned about what people on the ground are struggling with. Can you tell us a little bit about that in particular?
Yeah, I went out with a street medicine team to the Brick Church Warming and Cooling Center. The street medicine team goes out to a different location every morning to try to reach people where they're at. And so they go to different shelters. And on this morning they went to the Brick Church, and they set up a clinic kind of in the back, and they had all these patients that they knew were there and that they could find there, and had a long-standing relationship with them. And it was pretty interesting to talk to everyone there because they had this sort of perspective of what they had seen themselves and the change over time. And so they provide referrals for opioid treatment medication for the people that they see, and they provide wound care for people who that can come with opioid use, and just checked on patients that they hadn't seen in a while. And made sure to get people connected with different resources that they needed while they were there. And so one of the people I spoke to was liaison with a state program that's trying to reduce overdoses. And she's been working in this field for 20 years. And she said that she's really started to see a change of more older adults and doing harder drugs. And she was the one that talked about how when she first started working with people, a lot of it was prescription drugs. And then as overprescribing practices were changed, people started to turn to these illicit drugs. And now we're seeing older adults struggle with that pattern. And I also spoke to the pastor of Brick Church who runs the Warming and Cooling Center. And he said that he has also seen an increase in older people that he serves. They make up a small portion of the people they serve, but anecdotally, he's starting to see an increase as well. And so that's where I started to kind of, think, well, if all these people on the ground are starting to see something, even if it's maybe not showing up in the data yet, it's important to kind of pay attention to what people are seeing in their experiences. And it was interesting because I tried to talk to some of the patients there, and I spoke to one woman for a long time who was very candid and happy to talk to me, but she insisted that I think the first thing she said was N no drugs, no drug use, you know. And then when I spoke to some of the people at the shelter, they said, yeah, that's something that she's still struggling with right now. But they're not going to tell you that. And I think that speaks to some of the stigma that the older population feels around this topic that younger generations don't feel as much, according to all the people I spoke to. It can be harder for older Mainers to talk about opioid use and to reach out for help, and therefore it can be harder to kind of recognize get your hands around the larger challenge that's there.
Yeah. And we should say that this is the Union Street Brick Church in Bangor. And that when you, after you spoke with the people who were helping others there, that kind of led you to look into the data a little bit more and try to figure out whether we could see in some data set, whether what people were seeing on the ground could be reflected in some way in the data. So it's
Yeah.
interesting to hear your reporting process from, from the anecdote to actually coming around to this place of here it is in the data,
Yeah,
and
and
out.
well, I was just going to add too, some of the data experts that I talked to said that it can take a while before what people see on the ground can start to show up in the data itself, which is why they really take into account anecdotal experience of what people are seeing on the ground, because sometimes the data can lag. And so to your point, it felt like, well, is there a disconnect between what people are seeing and what some of the data shows? But then when we looked at Medicare claims data, we did start to see that shift that some of the people I spoke to were experiencing.
Yeah, and Maine is not alone in this. As you also learned, there ha are some pretty startling national numbers around older adults and opioid use. Maybe you want to share some of those?
Yeah, so primarily the number that really stood out to me was that we're seeing this threefold increase nationally of older adults with opioid use disorder just in a 5-year time period, which was really striking. And then it's also important to note that over in like the last, I think, 20 years, we've seen an increase in older adults and overdoses. And Maine is no exception to that. So we're seeing this increase. A recent study found a 9,000% increase in overdose deaths of older adults nationally from fentanyl mixed with stimulants like cocaine and meth over the last 8 years. So that's a pretty striking statistic that is concerning, and just some of the doctors I talked to said just the presence of fentanyl in use among older adults is a change and is a concerning change. And then, we've seen between 2014 and 2023, the number of overdose deaths among people who are 55 and older increased threefold nationally and fivefold in Maine. So, we're seeing it all across the country, but it seems like we're really seeing a change here in Maine that's higher than the percent change nationally.
You're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Today, I'm joined by Rose Lundy, who covers public health. We're talking about older Mainers and opioid use. Yeah, there's, all of this must have just, some implications for treatment, implications for communities. What is different about treating an older population with opioid use disorder?
Yeah, so it's, some of the doctors that I talked to who work directly with this population, they say, one of the main challenges is that opioid use, can mimic some of the things that you see with just related to aging. So, for example, cognitive effects that come with opioid use can also look like cognitive effects that come with aging. So you might see memory loss, loss of ability to function, increased fall risks. So sometimes that's hard to distinguish. And then older adults have more health challenges generally and more prescribed medications. And those medications can interact with opioids in different ways. And then they might have more chronic pain. And sometimes it can be hard to find non-opioid treatment alternatives for chronic pain, which makes it hard to treat older adults. And then finally, like I said, pretty much almost everyone I spoke to talked about how stigma is a real challenge, that older populations feel stigma around opioid use and drug use more strongly than younger generations. They talked about how younger people are more willing to talk about it openly, to seek help. And older adults still find a barrier there and find it to be a challenge to reach out about it. And so these doctors that I spoke to said that sometimes that can make it really hard to try and find out if there's some opioid use disorder there. And so when they're asking questions around how their patients use their opioids, then their patients feel it can be a little bit more defensive and offended by the questions, which can make it harder to ask. And one of the doctors I spoke to said it was, if you ask about their some of the patients he works with, if you ask directly about their opioid use, they might start to think they can feel offended by it, and so that makes it harder to broach that subject. And he said that he might be more likely to do a random, drug screening for someone who's younger than for someone who's older.
That sounds like it. There are a whole host of challenges that can come with trying to identify and then also treat people with an addiction to opioids. And maybe we also want to clarify something here about the difference between what could be a dependence versus an addiction. Is that something that you'd like to explain for our listeners?
Yes. Yeah, that is an important distinction to make. So this doctor I spoke to said that, what's really important to think about with an addiction in particular is that it's someone who is dependent on opioids, but then is also using it in a steadily increasing manner. The difference is that if you are physiologically dependent on opioids, you might experience withdrawal symptoms. But if you're kind of pathologically dependent, as he said, that means that you might use them to treat an underlying issue as well, like PTSD, anxiety, depression, and then in an escalating manner to the point that it becomes an illness. And so, both are important to keep an eye out for, but he said that there's not really good data on how many older patients are pathologically addicted to opioids, which makes it hard to track the problem and try to see where we're going, going forward.
Yeah. There also is somebody who you spoke with who talked a little bit about how, especially with older adults, it can be harder to treat them if they need to be in a nursing home or in another type of assisted living facility, which would be a particular challenge for this population. Could you talk a little bit about what this practitioner saw and the challenges she was trying to address?
Yes, definitely. So a couple of the people I spoke to actually said that it can be hard to find a higher level of care where someone can go and still receive their treatment for opioid use disorder. Sometimes their patients have a hard time getting their methadone at a nursing home because it's often dispensed at regulated clinics. And she talked about how it's difficult to just switch from methadone to another treatment in order to get into a nursing home, because that could be destabilizing as well to switch between different treatments. And then, I spoke to one woman who was a physician's assistant in a nursing home, and she was working with the geriatric substance use population. And so she got a grant a couple years ago to try to help nursing homes update their policies and make it easier and more effective for residents in nursing homes to receive opioid use disorder treatment. And so she went around the state. She spent a year working with numerous nursing homes to help them establish and expand their policies to better serve their residents. And she talked about how she made very little progress and met a lot of pushback on that, primarily because, she worked with a number of nursing homes that did try to update their policies, but there was so much turnover in the nursing homes, which is a challenge for nursing homes going already. And so she'd have to work with new people and get new buy-in from new administrators. And some of them updated their policies, but never put it into effect. And so ultimately, the only nursing homes that effectively changed their practices were the two that she was already working at. And so she didn't have a lot of success with that effort, but we are likely going to see more people going into these nursing homes that need this treatment. I mean, we're seeing the increase in the Medicare claims data, and those are people who are 65 and older, and presumably some of them will need to be in nursing homes. And then also, I spoke to the nursing home industry group, the Maine Healthcare Association, and they said that they are seeing increases in residents with substance use disorders. And it just reflects a broader shift and a change going forward. And so it's something that probably isn't going away, and could be something that we need to be thinking about going forward.
Rose, you also did a story somewhat recently on men's loneliness. And tell me a little bit about why you decided to look into this topic.
Yeah. So, I'm a health reporter. I write a lot about older adults, older Mainers. And something that comes up a lot is the challenge around isolation and loneliness across the state. We're a very rural state as well, and we know there's a lot of older adults who still live at home and maybe are isolated in a more rural area. But you can also be isolated in a an urban, very populated area. So it was something that was already on my mind. And then I heard about this group that was trying to particularly focus on older men because they can be find it even harder to find social places to socialize. And so, they were trying to address it by finding things in particular that older men might want to go to. And so this was, something that I think is especially important to think about in Maine because we have, my colleague did a story about how more older Mainers die by gun suicide between 2009 and 2023 than they did in car crashes. And that really, caught my attention. I mean, that's very concerning. And then nationally, older white men are dying at a higher rate of gun suicide than any other group. So when I heard about this group that was trying in particular to focus on older men, I was really interested in that, and I thought that that was a pretty a good idea to try to specifically target that population and try to give them some opportunities to get together. And that made me wonder if there are other groups in the state that are doing the same thing. And so I spoke to this first group called Romeo, which stands for Retired Older Men Eating Out. It started in Harpswell when a group that focuses on older adults applied for a grant to try to help older men in the area get connected and find ways to socialize. And so they started with a bunch of focus groups in the area to ask men what they would want to do. And then with those ideas in plan, last year they started, they kicked it off with a cookout with antique cars. And so they had a bunch of antique car drivers show up so that, and hosted a cookout, but it was not the most well attended right off the bat. There were 22 car drivers. They brought half of them brought their spouses. There were 10 volunteers, so there were more than 30 people throwing it this kickoff event, and only 10 guys showed up. So they were a little disappointed by that, but then since then the group has grown. They've hosted a number of events. Their most recent one had 57 attendees. So just in a year, they've seen a really big increase in the participation. And so they've had a range of events. Like they had a former New York Yankees manager and a local sports anchor. And then they also had a night sky expert who could come and talk about what you might see in a telescope. And then they also have some informative sessions that the guys themselves requested, such as a presentation from the sheriff's office about ways to avoid scams. And the whole thing is they put on these events and then they have a lunch so that the guys have a reason to come and do something together, and then they can eat together afterwards and socialize. And the organizer said that was really important because the men in their area they didn't think that they would come and just chat. It's good to have something to do, to give them a reason to gather. And then after the fact, then they can chat and make connections and socialize. And he told a story about how one guy who had participated in the focus groups, he said afterwards, he was like, "Ah, I'm probably not going to do it. It's not my thing. I'm only here at the focus groups just because my wife asked me to come and help out, but I'm probably not going to go to these events." So he didn't go to the first handful. And then he showed up to, I think, like the sixth one or something, and he sat in the back and he wasn't really engaged. But then The same man came to the next one and he sat in the middle and he was a little bit more engaged. And then they took a break for the summer. And when they had their first one back this year, that same gentleman was in the front and he was chatting with everybody and he was really excited to be there and had made a lot of friends. And the organizer said, that's what it's all about, you know, kind of bringing people in, giving them a place to socialize and meet with other people and really kind of build a community that way. But it was interesting because when I reached out to find out if there were other groups doing the same thing, I talked to two other groups and they had the same goal, but a different approach. One of the groups was is the Congo Craftsmen, and they're in Bethel, and they have been going for 20 years. They started out as a church group, and it was just a couple, it was some guys in the congregation who the church asked to fix up some pews in the church. And so they did that. And then from there, it just snowballed into doing all these other craftsman jobs for different nonprofits and organizations in the community. And they just do it in the organizer's garage. And he said that he echoed what the other group said, which is it was important to have an activity. The craft really brings the guys together. And then they have coffee afterwards and they chat and they, you know, build community that way, but they're really there for the activity, the kind of the task in the beginning. And he also said that all of the guys are retired people who previously really were successful in their careers. And when they retired, they found it hard to wake up on a Monday morning and not have anywhere to go. So they have their craftsmen gather Monday mornings to give them somewhere to go, give them a sense of purpose, and then also accomplish something for their community, and they can be together while they do it. And what was interesting is then the third group I talked to, which is in the Sakopee Valley area, they started because two older men reached out directly to a like an aging services organization in the area and asked specifically for a support group for older men struggling with things like memory loss and loss of their partner. And so they formed specifically to be a discussion group. They don't have any other activities and they like having it really focused and tailored on the discussion itself. And one of the members that I spoke to said, even when the discussion kind of strays away from more in-depth topics, they try to bring it back. So they really try to focus on the talking and the discussion rather than getting distracted by other things. You know, he said they made a rule that they can't talk about politics. And I just assumed that meant that they all disagreed about politics. And so I asked him that. And he said, no, actually, we all agree. And that's the problem. We kind of use politics as an excuse when the discussion about their personal challenges becomes too uncomfortable, then they notice that they would turn to politics as a place where they all could kind of agree and rant together. And they decided that, no, actually, let's keep focusing on the conversation that makes us uncomfortable because probably that's the most important topic for us to discuss.
Thank you, Rose. You're listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Today, I'm joined by Rose Lundy, who covers public health. We're talking about older Mainers and their challenges that they face in Maine, including opioids and loneliness. Uh, So Rose was just telling us about some groups that have coalesced, different groups across the state to bring men together. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about how the response has been to those groups and
Yeah, it's been great. There's been a lot of interest in the groups. a lot of the people who I reached out to asked me to get them in touch with the groups that I wrote about. Some of the group in Harpswell is already quite large, and they're very focused on the people in their area. So they seem to be they have to provide a lunch, so they can only provide to so many. But I was very encouraged to see that there's a lot of interest in it and a lot of people wanting to participate and drive long distances, frankly, to try to be parts of a part of these groups. But the most interesting response I got was from a woman saying, "Well, what about groups for women? You know, I know older men get a lot of the attention because you kind of assume that men are less sociable than older women as they age." But she was having struggle in her area trying to connect with people. And she even talked about she's lived in Maine for decades, most of her life, and finds it hard to break in as a woman and was hoping to find similar opportunities in the area. And so I don't know. It just kind of reminded me that loneliness and isolation isn't a isn't something that only one group of people experiences, and there should be supports and resources for everybody around the state. And so I think she got connected with a couple of different groups that will hopefully help her have the same kind of outcome as the men in these groups.
Great. It's always interesting to hear the reactions that we receive once we publish something and how that can create connections maybe that didn't exist before. You've also written about how there is currently higher demand for assistance among older adults in Maine who are trying to enroll in Medicare. And Medicare Advantage plans. And you found some like some surprising something surprising, I think. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we are currently in open enrollment for Medicare. and there are these area agencies on aging across Maine who every year help Medicare recipients enroll and pick their plans. And they said this year, far more than other years, they're just seeing really heightened demand for those services. Some of the places were booked up. The very first day that open enrollment opened, I know the Aroostook agency, they served more than 100 more people this year than last year. And in southern Maine, they saw a 37% increase in calls for assistance, and they filled 500 slots within 2 weeks of open enrollment. And so it just shows that there's huge demand for help this year. and there's a number of reasons for why that is. The first one is that a number of insurance carriers in Maine ended their Medicare Advantage plans. And so that means that an estimated 36,000 Mainers will have to find new plans. And so the carriers include Aetna, Anthem, Martins Point Healthcare, United Healthcare. They're all ending plans this year. And so what that means is that they might have to go back to the drawing board and look at their options. And so when you enroll in Medicare, you have basically two paths that you can take. You can stick with original Medicare, which means that you then enroll in Medicare Part A, which is hospital coverage, Part B, which is medical coverage, and Part D, which is prescription coverage. And Part D is where you have a lot of different plans you can choose from, depending on your, what you want in your prescription coverage. Or you can choose Medicare Advantage, which is through a private carrier. It rolls all those parts together into one plan, and it's approved by Medicare. So it's an it, but it's through a private carrier. So when those insurance companies ended the Medicare Advantage plans, that means that the recipients had to go back and either decide to find a different Medicare Advantage plan or enroll in original Medicare and look for a different Part D plan. So that's very complicated, as you can imagine. And people, when they, there's more people who are looking for assistance with that. And even if you didn't lose your plan, it's some of that uncertainty just prompted people to want to reach out and get help. So that's one of the big things that's different this year that's driving a lot of demand for more help from these agencies. There's also the agencies also talked about how there was less guidance from the federal government this year about first and foremost, they didn't release information on Medicare premiums until November. And that makes it really hard for people to know what their plans could look like. And also, these services rely heavily on Medicare volunteers. And so the volunteers help provide a neutral, unbiased perspective and just help people navigate the systems and find what works best for them. But the training relies very heavily on guidance from the federal government. And that was less forthcoming this year. So that made it really hard for agencies to know how to train their volunteers this year and what to look out for. So some of the uncertainty at the federal level also made it challenging. And then particularly in the Bangor area, there was the dispute between Anthem and Northern Light that went on for a long time, where it wasn't clear if they were going to continue their contract. And so that uncertainty created a lot of turmoil for people in the area, that are Northern Light is the major health system in Northern Maine. And so if they hadn't continued that contract, that would have been major disruptor. They ultimately did agree on a contract. And so the agency I spoke to up there thought that a bunch of people would cancel their enrollment assistance appointments because they, now there was a contract in place. But she said that few of them did, and they still wanted the help because they wanted to look at options in case that same contract dispute, happened again in the future. And so ultimately, all of these places are booked up, and it makes it really hard for people who still need assistance to find anywhere to go. There are walk-in clinics. But then also there, people are sending those who still call in, they can call 1-800 Medicare. They can go to medicare.gov for assistance. And they can also go to a trusted advisor. So I spoke to one of these people who is a trusted advisor who's not associated with the agency, and she's been helping people with health insurance for many years. And so she's taking people's in her area, in the Saukapi Valley area, taking them on and helping individuals as she can. She was hoping to step back this year, but there was just so much demand that she's still getting involved, trying to help people find where to go. So if you're hearing this and you're still planning to enroll in Medicare, there is some assistance out there. And certainly I would call 1-800 Medicare or go to medicare.gov because they can also help you virtually enroll. But I think it just points to all of the turmoil that we're seeing across the board this year in health insurance, some of the challenges, increasing premiums, and just the uncertainty that a lot of people feel around this topic and concern about what could happen going forward.
Yes, absolutely. You've also written about how health insurance rates more generally in Maine are set to skyrocket. That's something that affects so many people across the state. Maybe you could share a little bit about what you've learned reporting on healthcare costs more generally.
Yeah, we're going to see, and we are seeing health insurance premiums skyrocket across the state and across country, honestly. And then, with the potential expiration of the enhanced premium tax credit, people are also going to lose a lot of the assistance that they've had with their premiums going forward. I believe that's still under discussion, so we don't know what will happen with that yet. But undoubtedly, we're going to see increases, and we're already seeing increases in the health insurance rates. When I reported about this a couple months ago, the reason I was told why we're seeing the increases is primarily rising costs of prescriptions. They're just getting really, really expensive. Particularly GLP-1s, which are, known as kind of weight loss drugs, are really expensive, and there's more people using them. But also, just prescriptions across the board are getting really expensive, and so, health insurance carriers are increasing their rates for that reason. And then in Maine, in particular, we have a challenge because we have very little competition across healthcare systems, which can drive up the cost of care. And so, we're seeing as a result, there would, some of the procedures can be more expensive here and more expensive to cover from a health insurance company. So we're, on January 1st, we're going to see a lot of people with a lot higher health insurance rates. And I think the ripple effect of that is also important to think about, where if health insurance is so expensive, we might see people forego it altogether. And but those people still have to go to the doc, they might still end up in the emergency room if there's an emergency. And when that happens, the hospital still has to provide care, and that becomes something called uncompensated care. And so that's a service that they will never get paid for. And hospitals take some of that into account. They plan on uncompensated care every year. But when you have more people without insurance, then you have more uncompensated care. And there's more and more that the hospital has to pay out for. And the result is then, the hospital may have to balance their books somehow if they don't have enough, coverage of the services they're provided. Then they have to have really challenging conversations around maybe they have to cut some services. And we're already seeing that happen here in Maine, where hospital systems and healthcare systems are retracting some of the services and kind of contracting as the costs become too great. We've certainly seen that with maternity wards. We've seen a number of them close in Maine due to, not enough births, but also just financial challenges as well. And so that's something we really need to think about as a larger ripple effect of the increasing insurance premiums, and if more people choose to forego insurance. But another thing that's kind of been popping up more and more, perhaps in response to all this conversation around health insurance, is this movement, I guess I'd say, towards direct primary care, which is a different system of providing care that tries to kind of forego insurance. And so the idea is that you pay a prescription, or you pay a subscription essentially to a doctor, a monthly amount where you get to then get all the basic services from them, and you can come in as much as you want, and you can come in as for as long as you want to receive their services at a basic level without having to have insurance. Although they do say that you need to have emergency kind of catastrophic insurance if something happens, and you would still need insurance to go to specialists and to get higher level of testing. But it will be interesting to see if we see more and more demand for that kind of approach to primary care going forward, if health insurance just becomes too expensive and too untenable. I think there's a real chance we'll see a shift to other options.
Thank you, Rose. You've been listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour, a collaboration between WERU-FM and the nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. To read Rose Lundy's stories and learn more about our reporting, visit themainmonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Erin Rhoda, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks for listening.